Now that we're on Zoom.
I just hit the record button for you, Mark, so go ahead.
I heard it. You are awesome. Boy, I already forgot. Welcome to the Society of Addiction Psychology conference call. We're happy to have you here, and this is a monthly call. I think most of you know. A couple of pieces of business. Please put your FaceTime, not FaceTime, what is this? Zoom on mute so we don't get all sorts of background interruptions. You mentioned lawnmowers. There's a lawnmower coming up here now, so I'm going to definitely mute myself. Anybody wants to talk about any confidential material, be aware that this is being recorded and eventually will be, I hope, posted on the SOAP website. Just to get in advance, our next call will be Stanton Peel, who's a well-known writer in the field, and he'll be talking about his approach to addiction. I think it's called the Life Process Program. So I hope you could join us for that. I want to get that in here before everybody logs off at the end. So today we'll be talking with Bettina Hoppner, who's the Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School. And she holds two appointments at MGH, the Associate Director for Research at the Recovery Research Institute and the Director of Biostatistics at the Center for Addiction Medicine. I first met her when she was the editor of the Addictions Newsletter, TAN. If you're a member of Division 50, you will be familiar with that. And if you're not a member of Division 50, why not sign up? I think I'm going to turn it over to you, and you can set up the format for questions or whatever. And again, I remind everybody to mute your call. Thank you. It's all yours.
Great. So how do you guys usually do it? Should I be planning on talking for about 40 minutes and then there's room for discussion? I definitely like taking questions while I go, but I'm wondering if I should stop early to leave time for discussion.
I find that it's usually better if you take questions going along, maybe every so often ask if there are questions. But that was a lot based on the telephone format. Zoom is a little different, but I think it makes sense to talk until a break point and then ask for questions. And, you know, we'll follow along with your slides.
Perfect. And we'll have until 2 o'clock?
That's about right.
All right, sounds good. So I just need to be somewhat mindful of inflowing folks. We have currently at 42, and I just want to make sure I don't miss anybody. On second thought, I should have given Hannah the task of adding those, but that was my hindsight. All right, so I'm going to be sharing. I know a lot of you have slides in front of you, but I will do screen share. Oh, hang on, let me add somebody real quick before I screen share. Here we go. So that you guys can see this. Actually, I'll do it this way. You can screen share. Now you guys can see us. Ah, here we go. And let me see if I can start a slideshow and if it works. Okay. Can everybody see that?
Yep.
Okay. And then in about five minutes, I should probably see if there's anybody arriving late because you know what? I can't actually see. Oh, sorry about that. I can toggle back to set anybody else back into the room. Da, da, da. Close. Manage participants. I'm just trying to see if anybody else needs anything. Okay, good. So we'll just proceed and hopefully I won't mess it up too much. All right. So now let me see if I can toggle back to this and actually move the slides. If not, we'll have to do this a different way. All right. So as I mentioned, and let me just, or as rather as Mark mentioned, I'm part of the Recovery Research Institute here at Massachusetts General Hospital. And our mission is to enhance recovery through science. And I just wanted to draw our attention to the recovery bulletin that we have. How many of you are actually aware of it? Because what it is, oh, perfect, I see some of you nodding and raising hands, excellent. So what it is basically our way of making science more available broadly because a lot of these papers are behind passwords and other settings where people can't access it. So our goal is to take recent science findings, break it down into implications specifically. Oh, good, I get it. you guys probably saw the admit thing, perfect, to break down implications for individuals and families actually seeking support for treatment professionals, for scientists and policymakers. And that comes out every month, and there's a listserv you can, an email list you can join. And I encourage you to do it. It's nice to get these reminders and stay on top of the field. So, but now I can't move my next slide. 1 second. Here we go. So what we also have within anything we've done, we have archived, and you can go to our search function and type things in. And that brings you now to the topic that we have today, happiness. Because, as I mentioned, we are looking for recent findings on recovery and addiction support. And when you type in the word happiness, you will find very, very, very few things. And that is true for the field as such, that we are not paying much attention to positive affect and happiness, at least not nearly as much as we do to deficits. So why target happiness? So there's two really good reasons. So the important one, hang on, let me just admit Carolyn here. So the recovery movement in and of itself, and now this is going to be tricky because I'm going to see you guys and can't see my slides. I may need to move you to the left. Here we go. Another one to admit. So the recovery movement itself, the expressed goals of recovery include things like finding inner peace, improving social connections and mental health, learning to enjoy life without substance use, and personal growth. And these are all the goals and the reason why people are seeking a recovery. It's what's fueling them along a very difficult path. And that is why it's important to pay attention to it. Scientists have increasingly argued that the substance use treatment field needs to move beyond the focus on reducing and eliminating substance use and start targeting the goals where we want to get eventually. Here we go. Sidebar. Oh, see me always moving these back and forth. I apologize for this, but it's a little challenging. So in terms of recovery, I'm not sure how many of you have spent time talking about what does recovery mean and how it should be defined. Is that a topic that's been coming up for you guys? So there's a couple of efforts, certainly for NIAAA and NIDA. For NIDA, they've talked a lot about it in terms of defining it as an actual. Was that a question? Okay, sorry. So for NIDA, they've talked about it as an outcome measure. Instead of just having as a primary outcome measure substance use, to really talk about recovery, which is what's supposed to be supported. And how would you measure that? What should go into that pie? NIAAA just wants to understand the whole process better, so they are taking more mechanistic view of it, but it's important to them as well. Oh, actually, let me move it here. Sorry. So studies have focused on how we might define recovery, and two studies in particular that I want to highlight that took very different approaches to figuring out what recovery is and what's important to it. One of these studies is the Cascuda study with about 9,000 individuals who defined themselves as being in recovery, and researchers basically generated a bunch of items that they thought might resonate, and individuals then rated whether or not they think that they belong within their own definition of recovery. Meanwhile, Joanne Neal from the UK, hang on, let me admit, did it differently. She did a series of staged focus groups, which was then followed by two former large sample evaluation studies. And again, the start was that treatment providers generate a list of what recovery should mean, and substance use disorder service users then refined that list. But this was more of an iterative process. It wasn't a one-shot. It was going back and forth of explaining why something doesn't resonate and what should be in there that hadn't been in there before. But when you compare what they came up with, there's a lot of commonality. So on the left here, we have a Neal study. On the right, we have a Cascuda study. There's factors about substance use and self-care, relationships, outlook, and then material resources showed up in one but not the other. And happiness, positive affect, purpose in life, those kinds of things show up throughout this list. So for the participants the study participants and the Cascuda study, the 9,000 folks, things that really resonated with them as being essential for recovery is things like being able to enjoy myself without substance use. That was a really important part for them. Then there's also things about relationships, getting on well with people, which is part of, you know, feeling good and being kind and experiencing kindness. That's an important part of it. In terms of outlook of life, feeling positive, feeling happy with one's quality of life. Those things are considered central by many folks in different ways of recovery. So that's why there is a real value and a need to talk about happiness. Hang on, let me just make sure I can switch again. So what's been the progress to date? So we have been assessing quality of life and positive affect much more than before. Many multiple expert panels have come out to say that, yes, quality of life is important and it should be measured. But when it comes to it being an actual outcome, I mentioned there's ways to underway to measure recovery, to really define what it means and how it could be an outcome measure, and quality of life is part of that, but there hasn't been much yet. And when we talk about actual treatments that target quality of life and positive affect and happiness, there's much less even. So that's where we're currently at. But why would we focus on happiness during treatment, during substance use disorder treatment? And I love this article here that James McKay wrote for addiction, for the debate section. And he argued that treatment should go beyond a focus on reducing or eliminating substance use to target greater access to and more time spent in experiences that will be enjoyable, otherwise rewarding. And the underlying rationale is that it's hard to go for recovery. There are many challenges. And something got to fuel that. There got to be positive things, something you draw energy from that keeps you going, because it's a sustained effort. It's a marathon. So enter positive psychology. Luckily for us, we don't have to start from ground zero. The field of positive psychology has been around for 20 years now. And this study is specifically designed to enhance and sustain the experience of happiness. And this field has actually led to the creation of positive psychology exercises, the explicit goal of which is to increase happiness. So the question then is, well, does it actually work? It's been around for a while, and we've talked about it a lot, but does it work? So there have been several meta-analyses at this point about it. So one of them, I reference it here, has combined the results of 51 studies across about 4,000 participants. And they showed that, yes, these positive psychology interventions that have been developed by many different people in many different fields using many different approaches, that they do have an impact on improving overall well-being and reducing depression. And positive affect and negative affect aren't just two opposites of one continuum. They are actually distinct psychometrically as well as other ways. But it has impact on both. So the really fascinating part about this research and this meta-analysis is that these positive psychology interventions are oftentimes very brief, self-administered exercises. So require, you know, homework you can give people that they can do on their own. And these exercises are entirely feasible. So the question is, okay, so you can do them, people will engage in them, but will the gains you make be sustainable? And another meta-analysis showed, and this one was across 39 studies, included overall 6,000 participants, and they showed that improvements in subjective well-being remained evident 3 to 6 months later. So yes, these gains are sustainable. And that's a pretty important point, given how brief and easy these exercises are. So this I put in earlier for the talk I'd given, but you guys already know about Google Scholar, so I don't have to say it. But the cool thing is about the meta-analyses that I listed, it's always worthwhile to go to the cited by. You can see over here the 982 findings. There's a lot of recent work about this connection between health and happiness and about linking them and how they are actually related prospectively over time. So it's worthwhile to see the new things coming out if you just go to the cited by feature there. So now the question becomes, 20 years ago, positive psychology came out. We've done a lot of work. These exercises have been developed. They work. They are feasible. People like doing them. The effects are sustainable. Why don't we use that? And the answer that's been put forth by Amy Krenzman and Sandra Resnick and Robert Rosenheck is that our fields are just siloed. We don't talk. Addiction psychologists don't talk to positive psychologists. And recovery doesn't talk to positive psychology. And the reasons, at least Resnick and Rosnick believe that there are two differences that might be underlying why we don't talk about, why we don't have more cross-pollination, more discussion amongst ourselves. Well, across our disciplines. And one of them is that in establishing the field of positive psychology, this sort of false dichotomy was invoked. Here was said that psychology must, in saying that we should be doing positive psychology, it was argued that psychology must pay as much attention to fulfilling the lives of healthy people as to healing the wounds of the distressed. And that sort of impetus suggests that only healthy people can benefit from a psychology of strength, and distressed people need continue to require negative psychology, that they are not ready for the other stuff yet. And that's one of the things that's potentially holding us back from cross-pollinating. The other difference that might be holding it back is that positive psychology is centered on an empirical approach. It was done by scientists, whereas the recovery movement is a grassroots effort, and there hasn't been, which sets it apart from many of the human service professions, the academy and empirical research. So there hasn't been much cross-pollination there for that reason as well. And those are two of the possible reasons of why we haven't seen more integration of these important fields. So then the question becomes is, can positive psychology be used to support health behavior change? So we'll be talking about how it can be applied to addiction, but in general, can it be, more broadly, can it be used for health behavior change? And here the answer is yes, it has been, in fact. Other fields are far ahead of addiction about leveraging positive psychology interventions to bring about health behavioral change. So the examples I wanted to mention here are smoking cessation, chronic pain management, and treatment of cardiovascular disease. So smoking cessation, that's the area that I'm most active in, and there are currently two studies that we have going on. Chris Kayla from Brown University pioneered a positive psychotherapy for smoking cessation and found that in-person treatment was effective, that the positive psychotherapy approach was effective for bringing about lower smoking rates and high abstinence rates. And now there's a trial going on where that is augmented mefotrexin component, where people have a better ability to be reminded of positive psychology exercises they need to do over time. And that's an ongoing study. So you have, if you know people in Providence and Boston, send them our way. The other study we have going on, and we actually, I shouldn't say have going on, because we are literally collecting the last data point this week, is our own app that we developed. And I have some screenshots here, and I will talk about this a little bit later, where we're using positive psychology exercises to support smokers in quitting smoking. I'll tell you more about that in a bit. So in smoking cessation, this has been pioneered, and this is also an addictive behavior, and there the initial results are very positive. Chronic pain management, I give you some references here for where the field is at there. In chronic pain sufferers, it's been shown that the induction of positive mood states using positive psychology interventions is associated with decreased bodily pain and increased pain tolerance. Which is an important thing to keep in mind for addiction as well. In cardiac patients needing to increase physical exercises, positive psychological traits have been found to be associated with more positive cardiac outcomes in patients with heart disease. So these are folks who have experienced a significant cardiac event which brought them to the hospital, and then they experienced this, they were part of this positive psychology trial. And prospectively, the use of the positive psychology interventions that they learned was prospectively linked with better increased cardiac health behaviors on the road, exercise, diet, and so forth, which, you know, actually it's a very difficult target. Even though these patients come to the hospital because of a heart event and have a very high risk of having another heart attack in the next year, getting them to exercise, it has been a huge challenge. And this positive psychology intervention is helping in that regard. It's actually reaching them for an otherwise very treatment-resistant population. And here you can see Jeff Huffman, who is leading that effort here at MGH. The great thing that they also note is that patients like doing these positive psychology interventions. It's something they enjoy doing. And I think that's critically important when people resonate with something, when it energizes them and they're willing to do it over time. I think it's a critical, important engagement part to keep in mind. So what do we know about positive experiences in substance use? So as I mentioned, in the addiction field, we have been doing relatively little about measuring positive affect and seeing how it is related to the process of recovery over time. What we do know is that the experience of positive emotions has been linked to resilience, and I think particularly in our current times, that's a very important topic. And actually, if you are interested more in happiness and resilience and health and those kinds of things, I refer you to the Happiness and Health Center at the Harvard School of Public Health, who has a special emphasis on resilience this year. Anybody interested in that, I'll be happy to send you the annual report and sign you up on that listserv to get more papers and virtual talks and so forth. So that's a big topic right now, how positive affect bolsters resilience. Positive emotions may also act as a buffer against family conflict, parental or peer substance use, and it may help rebuild a life outside of substance use. And I put the references for those findings down here, so you can look up those papers. When you actually look at treatment programs cross-sectionally, it has been shown that well-being is associated with fewer relapse in persons in residential treatment programs for addiction. And longitudinally, it's been found that higher life satisfaction has been linked with a greater chance of remission 1 to 2 years later. So there's increasing research pointing that to the importance of positive affect as you're going through this process. What about supporting behavioral change in the area of problematic substance use? Is it feasible? Can it be done? So, and for my research team, we come from smoking cessation, and there it comes very natural, and it seems a very good approach. But when you're talking about recovery from other substance use, you worry about the difficulty of recovery and how challenging it is. So one of our concerns was that while they're in this challenging time, perhaps it is and to then ask them to do these positive psychology exercises might actually be more of a reminder of things that are lost or lacking. So instead of empowering, instead of helping nurture those behaviors, maybe it's more a reminder of things that are not there or missing and could therefore backfire. That would be one concern of why such an approach might not be feasible. And as I mentioned, there isn't a lot there, but there are 3 pilot studies and 3 very different samples that have tackled that issue of how accepted is it, how feasible is it. And I will talk about these in a moment. Before I go in, there's any questions I should take? Anybody have a comment or question before I dive into these 3 pilot studies? Okay. And I also need to keep track. So Mark, if I don't pay attention and it's like 4 o'clock, please stop me.
Bettina?
Yeah?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I have 4 questions, and I think you may get to them, but just jot them down. You'll get to them, I'm sure. And no rush. Number 1, choosing the construct of happiness versus joy, fulfillment, satisfaction. You went through the literature, and I wondered about your thinking process as deciding happiness, number 1. Number 2, how is it related to behavioral activation? You know, is that an intervention? Number 3, kind of the order of delivery of happiness. Do you get people to be abstinent first or cut down, or do you address them simultaneously? And finally, individual differences. Who does it work for and who does it not work for? Because so many people, you know, really may need depression intervention before a happiness intervention. So 4 questions. If you don't answer them now, but you answer them in the flow of things, I'll be just as happy.
So I will say that the questions 3 and 4, I'm going to get to that in terms of some of the findings we have found. I will address that. In terms of the first question of why happiness, why not gratitude, why not optimism, why not something else, all of those positive emotions have been studied as well and they continue to be studied. I personally like happiness because I think it's something that we are almost ashamed to talk about, right? There's so many other things that seem more dire, but happiness are things at the core of giving us strength, of motivating us, of moving us forward. And even though it seems frivolous to talk about, especially in a scientific venue where you should probably say positive affect or other things rather than happiness, I think it's critical to what we all want and what everybody should have every day, not just sometimes. And there's actually some literature emerging right now that links positive affect more more so than gratitude and more so than optimism to improved health behaviors over time and improved health outcomes over time. There's an emerging strong literature on that. And the other questions about who's it good for, we will get to those, I promise. All right, so for these studies here, any other questions before I proceed? All right. So for these pilot studies, Acta and Bonneville in 2010 did a randomized trial of 20 adolescents. Half of them received no treatment, and the other half received the 8 weekly workshops. And you can see, to some degree, the topics that they had during these weeks. They had, here, let me move this, so you can actually see it. So they targeted positive emotions and savoring, gratitude and optimism, personal strengths, relaxation, meditation, goal setting, relationships, and then in later weeks I got into nutrition and physical activity and resilience and growth. So they did those for 8 weeks, and then the other group did nothing. And when you compare those increases in subjective health, happiness and in decreases in alcohol consumption were seen in the treatment but not in the control group. And the office also noted that the people assigned to this intervention, which is adolescents attending alcohol and drug treatment services, liked it. They didn't just laugh this away and say, this is stupid. It resonated with them. They enjoyed engaging with it, which, again, is an important component. Krenzman then took 23 adult outpatients in treatment program for alcohol use disorder, and she did it a little different. She did daily emails for 2 weeks, so everybody had to complete the 3 good things. You can see it here. So basically it says, please describe 3 good things that happened to you in the past 24 hours, describe it, and then also describe what caused it, what made it happen. So it was a self-reflection exercise, and people completed it every day for 2 weeks by virtue of just emailing back. So pretty low tech, but 91% of participants completed every day. Again, demonstrating, you know, that the feasibility of doing it. I mean, if you talk about medication adherence, I mean, this is not medication, but this is treatment adherence. It's a very good number of, you know, doing this every day over email for 2 weeks. And the results here show that increase in experience of calm and peaceful dimensions of positive affect. And then more recently, Carrico et al. In 2015 did a pilot study in 21 with amphetamine-using men who have sex with men, and they added a 5-session positive affect component to contingency management in a randomized trial. And they as well saw very high treatment completion, 98% of the participants, and they found increases in positive affect over the short term, though these effects were not retained for the long term. So these 3 very different groups of patients reacted very positively and shown some initial indicators that are suggestive of beneficial effects. Now we get to the stuff that I've actually done. And what we have done is because we had our concerns about how would this resonate in a group of folks who were in recovery. So we decided to do an online randomized survey. And we advertised the survey on Craigslist, but also targeting specifically about recovery support social networks like Smart Recovery, Women in Sobriety, and a variety in the rooms, a variety of other social network sites for recovery. And we said, hey, we have a survey. Would you mind doing it? And we asked them, what role do you think happiness plays in recovery? And this is, Bruce, to your question about at what point do you do it? Do you do it sequentially? Do you do it at the same time? And we gave them these options. That what role do you think happiness plays? Is it a goal? Is it a pathway? Is it both? Or is it just not relevant or even hindering? And then we asked them how important they think happiness is to their recovery process. And any hints of what they probably endorse the most? Any guesses?
Happiness. First?
Yeah, so what is the role of happiness? Is it a pathway, a goal, both, or irrelevant?
A goal.
I'm guessing both.
Irrelevant.
Goal and pathway.
Okay. So here it is. Overwhelmingly, it's both a goal and a pathway. And then even like if you look at the orange slice and the blue slice, the orange is just a goal and the blue slice is just a pathway. Even there you can see that it's tremendously important while you're going through it. It's part of the pathway. So to me, Bruce, this would suggest that it's something that you don't wait with. It's something to do now rather than later. At least that's what the participants in our survey suggested to us. And then we ask them, how important is it to you? And you can see here, this is 80%, so from a 0 to 100 scale. It's fairly important to them. And we saw it earlier in the definitions of recovery, right? It's what's essential to your recovery. And it is these kinds of dimensions of positive affect, of being able to enjoy life outside of substance use. So then in our survey, I mentioned it was a randomized survey. It got interesting at this point. So we asked them, how happy are you feeling right now? Then we asked them to do an exercise, and then we asked them again, how happy are you feeling right now? And they were randomized to complete one of seven exercises. Five of them were positive psychology interventions, and three of them were control exercises. So I'm not sure how detailed I should be about these exercises, since you might, a lot of you already know them. So we did the three good things, which is based on the three good things that you've heard earlier, and the one that used, that Amy Krenzman used. We did it without the reflection part of why, what caused it, and how did it come about. We just asked people to be mindful of three good things that happened. We also did, you can't see the birds, let me move this, but it's very cute birds. The experiencing kindness. This is something that we came up, and this is based on findings about that show that just writing about your blessings in one's life is a means of increasing happiness, and also counting one's own act of kindness also increases happiness. So we did an exercise about experiencing kindness, and we asked people to think back over the day and describe an act of kindness that you have done and that somebody else has done that you've just witnessed. Just raise awareness of kindness in your life. Savoring. This has been one of the exercises highlighted to be most important to a sustained happiness over time. It's the activity of really experiencing a positive emotion as it is happening, to really consciously attend to it and live it. Rose-born bud. This is something that just came up in discussion. It's out there. People do it. So it exists, you know, for motivational speakers, for and nanny circles, and you guys probably have seen it before, this rose thorn bud idea. But basically the exercise asks you to think over the past day and to think of the best thing that's happened to you, your rose, the worst or most challenging thing that's happened to you, and something you're looking forward to. So it kind of balances the attention to the good things by also saying, we understand that the good and the bad happen at the same time, and tomorrow is another day, and to really tie it all together. So we did that exercise as well. And then we're living happy moments. When you want to induce mood in a clinic, in a laboratory context, that's what you do. You show people pictures of kittens and other things that make people smile. And by that virtue, we decide to ask people to take a look at their own pictures on their smartphone, on just photos that they're standing on their desks or wherever they are, and to describe the happy moment that they're seeing. So they're engaging with that happy picture that they self-select from their personal life. And then for the control exercise, we were really torn about what our control exercise would be. We thought a neutral control would be important, so we asked them, what are three things that you experienced in the past 24 hours? But it's really hard to come up with neutral things. Like, we struggled with this, like brushing my teeth or walking. But then the second you're given emotion, I mean, an activity, you usually have some kind of emotional components going with it. So this neutral control felt very unnatural in some way. But then we also thought it was important to include a negative control. Think back over the past day, what are three experiences that have been hard for you in the past 24 hours? And we really did this one because that's a lot of what we're asking people who are actively working on their addictions to do. Identify the challenges, come up with ways to overcome those challenges. There's a lot of attention on the things that are hard. So we thought that was a very valid comparison group as well. So what did we find? Two things. For one, the pre-pose, if you were in the happy conditions, the five positive exercises, if you did any one of those five positive exercises, your happiness went up 4 minutes later. And in the control group, when you were exposed to either one of our two control exercises, happiness went down. And I think both effects are important to consider and to keep in mind. So then we asked which exercise worked, ourselves, which one worked best, and we just did the effect sizes. And note here that this, of course, is in the opposite direction. We're just showing the size here of the effect. But you can see that this reliving happy moments exercise was actually the best one for us, where we had the most increases in positive affect as people looked at their own pictures and relived that moment Savoring was the next best one. And the underperformer here was three good things, and that might either be because we didn't have another component in there about reflecting about why that moment came, or because it just wasn't as good or didn't resonate as well as some of these other exercises, which were more personal and more experiential. But the reason why I say that both of these, and you look at these three hard things, right? That's like the second strongest effect that we have in our group. The reason, as I mentioned earlier, we put a lot of attention on the challenging things, on the hard things, and that has an impact on positive affect. It decreases it. It takes resources away, and that's important to keep in mind, I think. So then we just asked people, how doable is it? And let's see. So we had 92% of the people who did complete the exercise. And here is the average amount of time. And on average, for this 531 people who participated in our study, they took 4 minutes to read the question and think about the question and write the answer, which is not long. It's certainly doable, but it shows active engagement. It shows thoughtfulness in the process. So they were actually engaged in it. And then we asked them these other questions about what would you do in exercise like this as a daily routine. And a lot of them, 33%, said yes for several weeks, if not indefinitely. And another 27% said yes for a little while. So that speaks to the buy-in that they could actually do it. You can see here, could you do it? 93% said, yes, I could. But when you ask them, would you actually do it? It's less, but it's still, 60% who could do it for at least a while and up to 90% who could do it on and off. And here's the other question, Bruce, that you had about where do you need to be? Do you need to target depression first? So we looked at the happiness scores that people had before versus right before the exercise. And you can see two normal curves here suggesting that there's two different populations, those who start with very low overall positive affect and those with high. So we actually grouped those into two groups and compared what their how well they were doing before versus after. So you can see here before and here after. And you can see ceiling effects. Those who started out with high happiness had a bit of a ceiling effect. They couldn't go anywhere. And those who were very low, their heart exercises didn't do much damage to them. But it's these other groups, people who start low, they were able to improve their positive affect given positive exercises. And those who started very high, they had a place to go down in terms of their their happiness going down in response to control exercises. So it doesn't only work for happy people, it absolutely works for folks who start out with low positive affect as they enter. At least that's what this suggests. So here we have our conceptual model, and it's largely based on what we know from smoking cessation, simply because we haven't done a lot of positive affect research in alcohol and other drug use disorders. But our current conceptual model, and I'd love to hear your input and thoughts if you have other ideas about how this would work, always happy to theorize about these things, is that a positive psychology intervention should maintain or increase positive affect. So it's not just that we want to increase people's affect over time. If you do, that's great. Like if you're starting a little, we would love to see that positive affect go up. But also maintaining it during a really challenging time that's going to drain resources, your personal strength resources. And we think if that positive affect can be maintained, then that would broaden your thought action repertoire so that you can think of more alternatives to actions you could take. Instead of using a substance, you can see other ways of relieving your stress, of interacting, of dealing with anxiety and so forth. There's more options in your toolbox rather than just one go-to. There's been links of positive affect to increasing self-efficacy, your confidence that you'll be able to stay absent or stay problem-free. There's evidence linking positive affect to a decreased defensive processing on self-relevant health information. When you're not feeling well and somebody gives you worse news about your health outcomes and where you're at, you're not really going to say, absolutely, it's something I can take on. It's more of a feeling of overwhelmment. Versus if you're feeling good and you have some personal resources, you're more able to say, okay, I can handle this and I can process that. You're not just rejecting it. You're more open to dealing with that kind of information. And also just it reduces the desire and urge to use substances that those kinds of findings have been found. So let me see how I'm doing on time. to see how quickly I need to move. What we did is, you know, this thought action repertoire I talked about, it's a really interesting concept to us, but very hard to measure. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Fredrickson's writing on the thought action repertoire, but she's developed this measure where you just tell people to name an emotion, to really live it and feel it, and then to write down anything that comes to mind, like a list of actions. And that's supposed to be reflective of if you're living with that emotion, can you think of more or of more or fewer things? And that's what we did in our Red Cap survey here. And we just gave them, we asked them to name the emotion they felt while doing the exercise, regardless of which exercise they were in. We thought that people in the negative conditions would be giving us maybe stress or anxiety, and people in the positive exercises would say happy. That didn't always work out, and I'll get to that. And then we asked them to really experience it and then to just write down actions that they could do. And then we simply counted those numbers, how many things, how many thoughts did they come up with. We lose a little bit of a signal here because there's a lot of noise. So in the happiness groups, only 66 to 96% of participants actually named positive emotions, which we didn't expect. In the neutral group, 60% named a positive emotion. I told you about how tough it is to get a neutral experience. Most things have some kind of emotional content. And then the hard things, even there, 13% still named a positive emotion. So, you know, then it becomes difficult to get the thought action repertoire, given that they were focusing on a positive emotion potentially during that in that induction phase. We also went through qualitative coding, where we ruled out things like writing down nothing, or I wish I were, or passive things like I wish I would hear from my friends, which are not actions that you have control of, that you can do. It's just text, but it doesn't reflect the ability that you have to take action. And here, the two best exercises are the yellow ones. The yellow ones are the one that we actually found a significant effect for. They are ones who just give you the effect size, but they were non-significant. But for savoring and rose thorn bud, compared to the three hard things, which you don't see here, compared to that one, they were able to list more actions. So completing savoring, completing rose thorn bud, those participants gave us more options of things they could do, given this four-minute exercise that they did. So what we conclude from this work is that happiness exercises seem to work best when happiness is not at ceiling levels, meaning there's places for it to go and to improve, and that there are times when there is a need to counteract expected negative experiences during a challenging time. And I would argue that recovery from addictive substances is, you know, describing both of these things. People are not at peak levels for ceiling. You have here a study that we did at the Recovery Research Institute that sort of show quality of life over years, and you can see that they start out very low in terms of quality of life and then increase over time. So there's really a lot of need to counteract, and therefore there should be a lot of ability to move that needle. So and this is for the last few minutes. I'm not going to talk too much about it because it's smoking. I don't think you guys care overly much about smoking cessation, but I wanted to show the app that we developed and that Laura and Hannah, who are on the call, helped significantly on, and Katie, who will be joining our team soon. So we developed this app, and this is what, Mark, actually, you saw that, right? And you saw this app, and you wanted to know more about it, and that's what sparked this call right here. So this is what we developed, and you can simply go to that link right here to read more about why we designed the app in the way we did and what the current evidence is for it. Or if you want to download it, tell me, I haven't put the name here, huh? So I'll definitely send it along later. But you can also simply go to the App Store, Google Store or iStore, Google Play or iStore, and type in smiling instead of smoking, and then you can download this app right here. Wait, was that a question? I hear some talking, but I wasn't sure. I couldn't quite make that out. I apologize.
I think someone doesn't have their mute on.
Ah, okay. Very good. I'll move forward then. So what we do in this app is we ask people to complete a daily happiness exercise. And you can see the screen there. We describe the exercise, and we also give links. We say, well, why should I do this exercise? And we explain why we picked this exercise and why it would be fruitful to do. And then we also give examples. If you click that dark blue button over here, that's examples, because it always helps to figure out what do you actually mean. And there's a variety of examples for it. And then people fill it out, and then it gets put into a log. So as I go through the days, they know, you know, all the, they have a log of their own happy moments, so they can browse through it over time. And then every once in a while, we send them a push notification and give them a research finding saying, hey, by the way, did you know? And we show them what the science is on happiness and health and being smoke-free. And then they click this little button. I'm not sure if you can see my cursor, but there's a read more button. If you click on that, it goes directly to PubMed, so you can look up the paper and see what it's actually about. And that's how we link those exercises. Here's just my plug for smoking cessation. I don't think I need to go into it. I think all of you know that smoking cessation is super important, particularly in this population, where the general population has 15% of smoking prevalence, and we are looking at 65 to 87% of persons with substance use disorder who smoke. And for AUD, at least, you're more likely to die of smoking when you are from alcohol. So it's an incredibly important topic to really address smoking prevalence in this population. But that aside, I wanted to just show you quickly something about the feasibility. We talked about Amy Krenzman's study, about how over 90% completed the exercise every day for 2 weeks. In the Carrico study, there was 98% treatment completion for the positive psychology. And in our case, for our study one, we initially only asked for a three-week period to do this for the week, for 1 week before your quit day from smoking and for 2 weeks following it. And you can see here a rather busy graph that the black line over here is engaging with the app at all. And this axis is the percent of participants who are doing it. So on day one, everybody used the app. And then over time, you can see here about 90% used it for the week leading up to the quit day. And this is the 2 weeks after the quit day. And people logged in. There was a little bit of a slump over here. And people were still using it. But then we looked at what function they were using, and it's a happiness exercise. Most of this overall high rate of use over three weeks was due to doing the happiness exercise. So they came for that, and while they were there, they would also engage in some of the ever smoking stuff that we did, which I'll talk about in a moment, the behavioral challenges and logging it and looking at risky times and strategies and all that kind of stuff. But so for 3 weeks, they were really doing it. And then, you can't see it here, let me move this part. We only asked them to do it for 3 weeks, and then said, you can continue to use it if you want, but there's no expectations from us. And a lot of people, as you can see, kept using it. And even like after they thought they didn't have to, they wouldn't talk to us anymore. Over here at like week 8, you can still see 40% of our participants using the app on their own because they liked it, presumably, or for whatever other reason, but they were still engaged. And that's something you don't see a lot with apps. With apps, you usually see this exponential decrease. People find an app, they use it for 2 to 3 days, and then they stop. That's the norm. But here we're actually keeping people. Now, this study here was an in-person study where we onboarded people, brought them to the office. We did saliva tests for smoking status and all that good thing, and then we onboarded them there. And then our next study, the one that we're just finishing, we're doing it just on the phone. We're just walking them through, saying, here's the app, go have good luck, and please use it. We also increased the amount of time. Originally we asked for 3 weeks, now we're asking for 7 weeks of usage. And I don't think I have those data here, but I can tell you, we're finishing up the analysis right now. We have lower initial sign up because it was not in person. We're seeing like a 60% who start using it, but then also continues. There's very little drop off throughout the 7 weeks we're asking for. Once they're on board, they are using it fairly or surprisingly consistently for a long period of prescribed app use. When you ask how did it help, we had a bunch of questions about it. It said it was a good reminder, it boosts confidence, and it reminded them that it was worthwhile to stay on track. We looked at these mechanisms of change that we talked about for the conceptual model, and we did find, at least for smoking, that it increased their confidence to remain abstinent, it reduced their urge to want to smoke, and it affected how they perceived smoking in terms of the pros going down and the cons going up. We looked at abstinence, which again is not much interesting for you guys right here, but we had point prevalence abstinence rate of 30%, which is pretty good compared to other apps that are out there. But until we do a randomized trial, which is our next thing that we're starting this summer, you know, anything's possible in terms of what those rates are, but here they are, 44, 48% for smoking abstinence. So the version here on the left, this is what Laura worked on. This is what it used to look like. This is what it currently looks like. So if you go to the Google Play or the iStore, this is what you're going to download. In about a month, this will look similar to this, but we actually have a new and improved version that is being put on live, and I'd be happy to let you know when that's out there. We're very excited about it. Because what we did also, we increased what we're doing, because the feedback we got from people is like, we like doing the exercises, but you're only giving us three exercises, and they repeat, you know, it's randomly chosen each day, but we want to do more than three exercises. So we actually have five exercises we had in the day. We wanted to increase variety, but we also thought that some things like the rose thorn bud and the savoring are so critical habits, you know, daily living habits that we really wanted people to engage in. So we decided to make habit building exercises, which have to be done every day. And then in addition to that, we are now offering these happiness boost activities that if you need, have a momentary need where you're just feeling down and you want to know what can I do right now to feel a little better, you have additional activities. And we have like 12 activities that are about music and fostering curiosity and appreciating beauty and seeing strengths and a lot of other things that we found in the literature. So we're offering those alongside that, so that we are trying to build daily habits while also offering boost activities. And hopefully that will be ready for you all in a couple of weeks. So this is what we do. The behavioral challenges I mentioned, we ask them along the way based on where they are relative to their quit day or things that they should be doing, like thinking about the reasons that motivate them, about the triggers that cause them to reach for a cigarette, the strategies they can use to combat them. They get badges along the way because everybody loves gamification. We ask them to log them when they smoke and how they smoke, and then offer strategies along the way. We ask them to log their personal reasons of why do they want to be smoke-free, and then at critical times that they tell us, we send them their own personal reasons saying, ah, but you want to quit because of your kids, so don't take that cigarette that you would while waiting for the bus, that kind of thing. And we also have a game in there, and we send them these facts about science facts linking health and happiness. And that's it. So the reason why I think it is so important to focus on happiness is that as we are working addiction, there's a lot of focus on the challenges, and there are many challenges, and they are real challenges. Just at the same time, those just focusing on the challenges takes away energy from that we need to sustain our efforts. So don't just think about the green elephant. Also put your attention, you know, you are where your attention is. That's a thing that my mom always said, and I think it's very true. You also need to be able to envision where you want to be and how you want to be. So you need to make room in your daily lives for happy emotions so that you can experience more of them. So that's it for me. What questions can I field?
Tina, I just wanted to note there's a couple questions in the chat box.
Oh, I can't see those.
Do you want me to read them out loud?
Shall I stop sharing, or should I go back for a slide for that?
So the first one was about just is the concept of positive versus negative emotions a foundation of the field of positive psych? Has happiness been operationally defined? Are there multiple definitions being used in multiple studies?
So, yes, so you've noticed me saying different things. I've said happiness, I've said positive affect. Positive affect combines a whole lot of things in terms of feeling calm, relaxed, happy, excited, joyful. We usually go back to the PANAS that many of you know, which is a positive and negative affect schedule. For the adjectives that people feel, and how often do you feel them. So, yes, there are a lot of different definitions out there. Happiness resonates with us, and we have some happiness scales that we like. But a lot of these positive emotions, anything on that positive scale, is important. And we have studied more negative emotions, stress, anxiety, depression, worry, fear. Those are all very important issues for us. But as I mentioned, psychometrically and neuropsychologically, they are not just opposites of one scale. They are truly two different constructs. So it's worth talking about each of them in its own right.
And then another question that was put in the chat box when you were talking about the online happiness survey. How does this research fit into the body of literature that claims that any and all types of treatment for addiction have about the same rate of efficacy?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting, and it's certainly something. Let me go back. I mean, do we have the findings?
Tina, People can press star 6 on the phone and it will mute them. It appears from the list that almost none of the phone callers are muted, and they could be. Star 6.
Very good. So that's a great question about, is this just going to be as effective or ineffective as anything else? We don't know. People certainly choose the treatment that resonates with them there. And I think it's important to recognize that every person is different. Every person's journey is unique. And some things will work for one person and not for another. And giving more options, I think, is a good thing. And giving an option for people to engage in something that motivates them, something that the recovery movement has found is something that people are striving towards, that they themselves say it's part of a journey as well as a goal. Mostly it's part of a journey, and this is why we need to do it right now. I think the fact that people like doing it is an important thing to capitalize on for treatment engagement, for sustained effort. So I don't know yet how it's going to pan out down the road, but I think it's worth investigating. It's worth investing some time and money in to figure that out. Whatever questions are there.
Hi, this is Mark Schenker, and first of all, thank you. This is a fantastic presentation. I'm really glad that we connected on this. And I know we've only got 2 minutes on the clock. If you want to go over, that's great. I have one major question, which is the SIS being adapted for any substance use disorders?
I am trying and failing at the moment. So I've been putting in an application here and there for trying to do it in substance use disorder. I have not met my success yet, surely partly due to my own grantsmanship, but also due to the fact that there isn't a lot of research on positive affect yet to say this is worthwhile to do. So I think we just need to publish more or research more and look more into how positive affect is related to it. I would love to adapt this. I'm continuously trying, if you guys know of pilot mechanisms that we can look into, because we have an existing one. It's a matter of tailoring, which is always easier than starting from square one. We would love to collaborate and put something together. But at current, there's no study underway that's doing it, but we are certainly hoping that we will be able to do that.
Thank you. I'm reminded of one of the first books I read in college, which was Maslow's Toward a Psychology of Being. And he differentiated between B needs and D needs. D needs being based on deficiency and B based on being. And in some ways, that seems like right there you have a foundation for the positive psychology approach. I don't know if anybody ever took it back that far.
Well, I certainly liked your example about seeing Maslow on campus joyfully kicking any pile of leaves. I think it's a great way to be in life, right, to enjoy the daily, the small victories, the small enjoyment in everyday experiences, which I think is important for all of us, especially in times of change and in terms of struggle. It's where we draw our energy from.
Yeah, I'm finding myself encouraging my patients to think that way. You only graduate high school once. Your kid only graduates college once. You can't wait for that. But every day, you could have a good day.
Bettina?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. You definitely answered my questions. And I always struggle with, how to choose the name of a construct that has been, that has been studied from different angles, but never quite from the one I'm thinking about. I also asked about behavioral activation, and I wasn't going to bring it up again, but people are getting funded and getting NIAAA dollars for studying behavioral activation and alcohol use. So I'm wondering if just the, and I love your use of happiness and I love everything you're doing. It's great, but I wonder if it's unfortunately almost like a marketing issue, because it's so similar to behavioral activation.
That's a great point. And you know what, I have to take a look at those grants and see how much commonality and overlap is it, and versus if there is more innovation there. That's a great reminder. Thank you.
Well, look at that. I will tell you that our center has one of those R01s, and it's Terra Fizzino's.
I will look at it.
So, yeah. So I'm just wondering about marketing, but I really so much like that you picked happiness.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate that.
Bettina, I have a question about if some of these exercises, you're almost like working like a gratitude or a positive affect like muscle, and it kind of builds over time. So I think in the survey that you had to folks, it asked a question about like how easy would these exercises be. Have you asked that question over time, and do you know if folks might find it easier? So like you are, you know, these exercises become easier over time?
You know, we haven't asked that question explicitly yet. We've only looked at whether or not people do it over time, and they do. It's a great question. Like our idea is that we are asking them at first rather artificially with an app to say, please do this, and at 7 p.m. we're saying, oh, you haven't done it yet, please do it now. So like coaching them along. And what we tell people on the app is saying that we are building your habit. Our hope is that after you've done this, it comes natural to you. You know, we ask you at first to savor experiences. We ask you at first to pay attention to the things that are good in your life. We ask you to create a kinder world, both by seeing the kindness around you and by acting kind yourself. And at first that takes conscious effort, but our hope is that as you're doing it again and again and again, that you just do it naturally. You don't need an app to remind you. You don't need to log it. You can if you want, but that you'll just do it naturally going forward. That's what we really hope for sustainable impact lies. But it's a great point that we should probably just ask them, you know, to see how easy or hard it is over time. Great. So then if there are no further questions, I will stop a recording if I can find out where I can do that.
I bet if you press the recording button.
You have to unpress it somewhere. Stop recording.